Lady Justice is a true crime podcast, therefore deals with incidents of violence, disturbing imagery, and explicit content. Listener discretion is advised. The Lady Justice podcast wishes to offer their deepest condolences to the victims' families and wishes to offer thanks to those that work in emergency services. Hello, my lovelies, and welcome to yet another episode of Lady Justice, a true crime podcast. Lady Justice is a weekly podcast that covers fascinating cases, both past and present. My name is Chantelle, and I'm your friendly true crime junkie with slight caffeine addiction issues. I hope this episode finds you all healthy, and I hope that you're having a glorious week. As usual, before I get into this episode, I do want to ask you guys a huge favour. Please support this podcast by subscribing, rating, and leaving a review where you can. And because sharing is caring, I do want you to tell everyone you know. Share it on social media and get the word out. It does make the world of difference. If you'd like to contact me about anything at all, please feel free to do so via social media or by my email, which you'll find in the show notes. This week, before the Act of Kindness, we have a promo for True Consequences. It's a favourite of mine without a doubt, and the host Eric really does shine a light on cases that I wouldn't know about in the New Mexico area. In this week's episode, a father and his two sons band together and kill the woman in their lives. This is the case of Killer Family. So, without further ado, here is some of the background on the location and time frame of this case. We are heading back to 1995. Queen Elizabeth is on the throne, and the Prime Minister, much to many's disappointment, was John Major. The year saw Middlesbrough Football Club move from Ayresome Park to their new stadium at the Riverside, and Frank Bruno win the World Heavyweight Championship. It was the year that saw Fred West hang himself in a cell. It also saw actor Peter Cook and everyone's favourite artist, Bob Ross, die. We're taking a trip to Dalton, Huddersfield, in West Yorkshire. It's an old town with a settlement being there since at least 4,000 years ago. It was at the centre of civil unrest after the Luddites fought against the Industrial Revolution, and it's the home of the Rugby League. Famous folk with connections to the town include former Prime Minister Harold Wilson, film actor James Mason, and music manager Rudd Smallwood. As always, all my sources will be listed in the show notes. Do you remember the last day of the school summer holidays? A day half filled with excitement and expectation, and half filled with nerves and upset that you can't lay in bed until mid-morning. You run around trying to squeeze the last bit of freedom out of the day, before heading home and winding down ready for you to walk through those gates once again. On Thursday, August 31st, 1995, that was the feeling that Glenn Howells had before he was due to embark on his last year at secondary school. The 15-year-old boy had taken the family dog for a walk at 9 p.m. His younger brother John was riding his bike around the neighbourhood. His dad was playing darts down the pub, and his mum was reading a book on the sofa. Just half an hour later, he made his way down the driveway of their bungalow on Dalton Green Lane in Huddersfield and went to the back door leading into the kitchen. As he drew closer, he noticed the back door ajar. It wasn't dark. There could have been a million and one reasons why the door was ajar, so he walked in just as he normally would. As he turned from the kitchen, he noticed his home had been ransacked. Furniture was overturned, papers all over the floor. The teenager called out for his mother, but received no reply. As he moved past the beanbag, he looked over to where he'd left his mother, on her spot on the sofa, and had to turn away instantly. Eve Howells had been attacked in her own home, her head noticeably caved in on one side, her face two bloody to see features. The boy ran over and checked her pulse. Scrambling for the phone, he called 999 and asked for an ambulance before running to a neighbour's to raise the alarm. His 14-year-old brother John had just come down the road, and the boy who had just made the discovery begged his brother to come with him. Just don't go inside. Well, that's what he told the police anyway. Eve was pronounced dead at the scene. The investigators were quick to assess the situation. The 48-year-old mum of two had been found slumped on the settee, wearing her nightie and dressing gown. Her head had clearly been battered with a heavy instrument, such as a hammer. The Howells family, at least looking from the outside, were a typical middle-class normal family. Evelyn, or Eve as she was known by most, was a religion and history teacher at Newsom High School in the south of the town. She'd been married to her husband David for 23 years after they met at a British Legion event in 1971, tying the knot 2 years later. David John Howells was a year younger at 47. He worked as an engineering technician after spending 18 months in the Merchant Navy and settling in Huddersfield to work at the ICI plant. He seemed to everyone like a normal bloke, a bit of a drinker maybe, just by his pot belly and frequent visits to the pub, but the light-haired man was just a normal family man. Their two sons, Glenn David Howells and John Alexander Howells, were just normal schoolboys. Being so close in age, they were close, sharing a bedroom, and they spent a lot of their time together. This is in a time before the internet became a norm in every home. So they were like every average kid, spending their time split between being outside or locking themselves in their room. When they were out, though, their boredom did lead them to a bit of trouble. Nothing major, just usually being known to kick fences or steal hubcaps, or hanging around where they shouldn't. Social services had called in the family due to these small offences, as a routine. Social workers walked into a clean home. There were photos of the family on holiday, all over the walls, smiling ear to ear. The boys were not failing at school. The parents both seemed like responsible members of the community. Their behaviour was just put down to teenagers trying to keep themselves entertained. With the investigations just beginning, led by Detective Superintendent Gary Haig of the West Yorkshire Police, they initially believed that the deadly attack on Eve was a burglary gone wrong. With the room ransacked and the door open, adding that £100 was missing, it was the most likely of all situations. The news of the attack garnered national attention just the next day, with Haig reading a statement saying, "This seems like a burglary which has gone tragically wrong. She was the victim of a sustained and vicious attack. It was callous and unnecessary and has left an entire family completely devastated." Glenn, the eldest son, who had made the discovery, was offered counselling, with David and John also being supported by specialist officers, and all seemed very hopeful that day when three men and a woman were taken to Huddersfield Police Station for questioning. It was on the 1st of September when the post-mortem was held. The pathologist had determined that she had died from blunt force trauma to the head, finding at least 12 separate blows. Police also issued a warning to all residents in the locality to keep their doors locked, stating that Eve most likely didn't even realise that someone was in her home until it was too late, as she was reading. On the 2nd, it was announced that the four suspects had been released the previous night on bail, pending further inquiries. Headlines read that the schoolteacher may have been attacked by someone she knew. Detectives had speculated to reporters that she may have recognised her attacker, possibly an ex-pupil, and that's why she was so brutally murdered. Investigators, as always, looked into her immediate connections. As we all know, you're far more likely to be murdered by someone you do know. Officers traced David Howell's alibi and movements. He'd been remembered by the barmaid at the pub as he'd requested the music to be played a little louder, and he was seen by more than one enjoying both darts and dominoes that night. Local residents were also questioned if they'd seen the boys that evening. Some said that yes, they saw Glenn with the dog at some point, unclear of the time, but he had been seen on the streets with their beloved pooch. John was often on his bike too, and the neighbours also had remembered seeing the boy riding about. On the third day of the police inquiries, a search was completed in the area surrounding the Howells family home, and the police found something they hoped would be a crucial clue, a blood-splattered glove. On the 20th of September, almost 3 weeks after the murder of Eve, it was announced that an arrest had been made. Due to UK law, the names were protected, as they had been identified as two schoolboys under the age of 16. The children were taken to Huddersfield Police Station, and just 2 days later, the press reported that two teenage brothers had appeared in Magistrates Court charged with Mrs. Howell's murder. It was almost a month after this that any further information about the investigation came to light in the national or local media. On Wednesday, October 18th, a man was arrested and quizzed by police in relation to Eve's murder. His identity was also not released until, on the Friday, the news broke that David Howells had been formally charged with the murder of his wife. And the two teenage brothers? Well, it became evident who they may be. On Thursday, the 16th of January 1997, David, Glenn and John were to face trial at Leeds Crown Court. It would last 4 weeks, with Mr. Justice Alicott overseeing the proceedings. They all entered a plea of not guilty, but Glenn went a step further and admitted manslaughter on the grounds of provocation. The seemingly normal family from sleepy suburbia was about to have their dirty laundry aired out to an entire nation ready to hear every detail. For the prosecution, Frank Muller, Queen's Counsel, opened with a statement that outlined what and why this case ended up with an entire household in the dock for murder. He claimed that Eve wasn't a caring wife and mother. In fact, she was an abusive and vicious woman who had subjected her family to living in fear for years. He said that David had concocted a plan and convinced his children to kill their mother whilst he had the perfect alibi, and then to stage the scene to look like a burglary. The now 48-year-old David promised his boys the good life, jet skis and holidays from what he would inherit from the life insurance, and told them there was no way that they could be caught. Muller then said it would have been true if it hadn't been for the dedicated work of officers, forensic testing and covert recordings of conversations between the fathers and teenagers after their arrest. The prosecution also claimed that the picture of a normal family presented to the outside world hid a dark lifestyle with abuse at its core. Describing Eve as strict and uncaring, there was testimony to be given that proved for uncomfortable hearing. Eve clearly liked one of her sons more than the other. Glenn was subjected to regularly having to give his naked mother full body massages, which naturally, as you can imagine, made the boy squirm as he tried to avert his eyes from her private parts. Both of the boys were made to give her a full pedicure, cleaning the dirt from under her toenails. She screamed abuse at the boys, for example, regularly calling Glenn a fat little bastard or a fat fucker. The mother would beat her children, tie them to the kitchen table, spit at them, and force them to abide by her rules and ever-changing standards. John would be rewarded with a dinner if he could complete her tasks well enough. No matter how hard Glenn tried, he would be sat with bread for dinner. Eve's dark side wasn't completely hidden, though. Neighbours described the Howells as a family from hell. Even as the boys were toddlers, screaming could be heard, And when it came to bath time, often they felt like they should call social services. One neighbour had a bandon sitting in his garden, saying, "The screams that come out were like someone was murdering them." Even Eve's stepmother, Mary Dyson, knew of her darker side, telling the court, "She never showed them love. It would seem though she despised her sons. She was very aggressive." Mary then continued that the boy's late grandfather, Harold, often walked out in disgust when his daughter started ranting and raving. As a teacher at the school, she was infamous for her presence. She terrified the children, gaining the nickname Evil Howls. A colleague named Maureen Smith was to say, "She created an atmosphere of fear like I've never experienced in 26 years of teaching. She was searing." Eve clearly wasn't a well woman. She suffered from an eating disorder that left the middle-aged woman at just 6 stone. She was also described as having a number of psychosomatic disorders by her doctor, who ended up prescribing the woman Valium and sleeping tablets. Her eating disorder meant that she was preoccupied with her family's eating habits and kept a padlock on the freezer. Eve would run every aspect of the home down to the last penny in the finances. There was testimony to say that David had begun to further push his plan for his children to murder their mother in the 3 weeks leading up to the day. But beforehand, there had been plots to try and rid them of Eve. One was when they were on holiday in Ibiza, when they planned to push her off a balcony at the hotel. Only when they arrived, they discovered their room was on the ground floor. There was one man in Eve's life, though, that couldn't get enough. Her lover and husband's best friend, 38-year-old Russell Hurst. At 10 years her junior, he was very close to the entire family. The boys would call him Uncle Russ. He was at first, of course, a suspect in the police investigation, but was ruled out after having a solid alibi. He gave evidence at the trial which contradicted other people's accounts of Eve. He explained how close he was to both David and Eve, so close in fact he was named on both of their wills in the event of their death. It was mere minutes until drama came to the courtroom though, when the man who had a strikingly similar appearance to David had a fit and fainted whilst on the stand. The judge commented, "Poor chap, he was only one line off admitting the adultery, so perhaps it's understandable." A doctor was called and he was taken to the local hospital until later that day when he was to resume his testimony. The maintenance fitter ended up detailing their affair, which lasted 12 years and ended in 1994. Testimony was also given about how the boys had dealt with the abuse they had suffered at the hands of their mother. Eve's aunt, Jamesina Stevewright, who was living in Edinburgh, described how she saw the children as differing personalities, saying that John was very affectionate, yet Glenn did not seem to like the company of women. The behavioural issues had been apparent for some time for the boys. John was referred to a child psychologist at the age of 5. When he would return home from a day at school, the boy would open up to 18 tins of food and take a single spoonful of each one before trying to hide them. John was known to urinate in litter bins and break toys. The psychologist said that he was trying to rebel against her discipline. Glenn was far more outward with his feelings, telling anyone who would listen how much he hated his mum. He would make frequent calls to Childline, though never speaking, and thought about escaping his situation, either through running away or committing suicide. On one occasion, he tried wrapping a scarf around his neck from the bunk beds. The only reason he stopped, because he never wanted to leave his little brother alone with her. This was always happening. In their formative years, Eve would take their favourite teddies and hold lighters to them, just so she could hear them plead with her through tears. She often wouldn't let them out to play with others, and if she did, and then they refused to come in, people saw her drag them inside by their hair. The times that they had been caught committing petty crimes, the police thought they were just kids playing up, and actually given them a playful nickname, the Cray Twins. A murder squad detective said, "They looked more like Laurel and Hardy than the Crays, but they got the name because they were known for petty crime." 3 days after they killed their mum, it was said to the court that the boys went into town to celebrate their liberation. They got their ears pierced. On Thursday the 23rd of January, the court heard how after Detective Superintendent Haig, a former school friend of David Howell's, had a gut feeling about David and his possible involvement in the murder. He applied to the court for permission to covertly record the family. The first time was being in the cells when David visited the boys on the evening of their arrest. It was using these tapes, the Crown claimed, that proved the father's collaboration in the murder, making sure the boys, quote, stuck to their stories. The jury heard 12 poor quality tapes, played through headphones. On one of the tapes, David can be heard over muffled sobs saying to his two boys, "We've just got to block it out. If you two break, then I'm in as well. So we've got to stick together. It's this jacket." The jacket that David was referring to was one of the exhibits in the courtroom, owned by the then 14-year-old John, that had been discovered in the search of the home, splattered in Eve's blood. David added, "He must have walked past when it was spraying out." On a later tape, David can be heard saying to his youngest, "It's your jacket that's caused this. We just never realised how much forensics could find out." The tapes also told of the two children's misery. John could be heard towards the end of the tapes after threatening to kill himself twice, saying in a defeated tone, "We thought we'd get away with it." Glenn, the boy who openly admitted to committing the deed, had far more sorrow. He can be heard weeping, saying, "Got no dad anymore. Got no mum and dad. Want me mum." Another damning piece of testimony for the father came from David's former cellmate when he was on remand, Barry Johnson. The two had been drinking alcohol in their cell, and Mr. Johnson testified to the court. "I said, 'If you weren't there then, who did it?' David said, 'Well, who else was there? Think about it.' I just kept pestering him to tell me. He said that it was his two children. He said he had decided to get Glenn to do it because he was the biggest. He said he wasn't bothered about how it was done, just to make it look as though it was a burglary." The first of the three defendants to take the stand was Glenn, now 17 years old. He was noticeably shaken and sobbed throughout his testimony, even at some points having to stop whilst the usher passed him tissues. Speaking in whispers, he spoke about how he finally snapped and saw red. He described his mum as a dominating character that he grew to hate over the years, and said that the end came when he wanted to just be a normal kid, like his friends. Glenn spoke to how Eve had just minutes before he took the hammer to her skull, that she had been screaming and shouting at them for not walking the dog properly, calling them cunts and as thick as pig shit. When he came back into the room with the hammer, he slammed down both the blunt and pointed end of the hammer into her skull repeatedly before halting in a state of shock and saying, "Sorry, Mum, I love you." Next, the boy told the courtroom how he returned to his room, placed his blood-stained clothes and hammer in a plastic carrier bag and gave them to his younger brother. Next, he began to tip items of furniture, such as the bureau, onto the floor and staged the scene. Questioned to where he'd gotten the idea to kill his mother, the teenager said that it was something that he'd picked up from watching television shows, such as Crime Watch, Taggart and The Bill. Glenn expanded on this, saying that Crime Watch was where he picked up the idea of using the hammer as a weapon. He told the courtroom, "There was no suffering or out. I didn't want my mum to feel a thing or suffer." Speaking to what he did after he staged the scene, he told of how he took his mother's pulse. His first thoughts were that he didn't want to be caught, before he raised the alarm by calling the ambulance and going to the neighbour's property. Glenn was also asked about his father's involvement in the murder and so-called plot, as suggested by the Crown, to which he claimed that David had nothing to do with it. He did admit that he did tell his dad on at least one occasion that he had thought about killing his mother. Under cross-examination, Glenn was asked, "Would you have killed your mother without the approval of your father, depriving him of a wife?" "She deprived me of my life," Glenn said. Next came John's testimony. He spoke of the moments before the murder took place. He claimed that after his mother had started to shout at them, he went to his room with his brother. Asked if he could remember the exact details of what happened next, he could not recall whether it was him that took the stonemason's hammer from under the bed and handed it to his brother, or if Glenn had retrieved it himself. Next, he said that Glenn left the room, continuing, "I heard a noise like a bang. I went into the lounge and I saw Glenn striking Mum. I was asking Glenn to stop. I was saying, 'No, no.' I remember saying, 'Kill her in some different way.'" From the pleading, his brother did stop and they both stood crying over Eve's body. Asked if this had been a deliberate plan, he spoke to how in the year before he had had conversations with his brother and father and that they had grown in frequency in the 3 weeks before, and the last that he could remember was in the week before that fateful late August night. About his feelings towards his mother, the child turned and said that he loved his mum, but did dislike her, and insisted from all the talk, he never intended or thought that the killing would happen. John also admitted to when the act was over, he collected the bag that contained their clothes and hammer and hid the evidence in a canal, which he later pointed out to the police. The last member of the family to enter the witness box was David. Asked about his marriage, he said that, "For quite a long time, it was a very strong marriage. But slowly but surely, there were arguments and differences of opinion and it was getting rockier." David claimed that he had no idea that his wife and best friend had been having an affair for 12 years, even whilst they were on holiday together in various sunspots around Europe, including in Spain where they first slept together. He told the courtroom that he had no knowledge of the affair even months before Eve's murder, and it wasn't until he was questioned by police and then received a letter from Russell whilst on remand that stated, telling the courtroom that he had no knowledge that there was an affair, even in the months before the murder. He said he didn't know until he was questioned by police and then received a letter from Russell whilst on remand, which stated, "I would much rather be telling you face to face, but I understand you don't want to see me. I want to apologise about me and Eve." The real issues, David said, began in 1978 when tragically they lost their first child, Gareth, at just 3 days old. Eve never really dealt with the pain and said it was at this time that she gradually became more distant and eventually aggressive. Now, you would expect as a parent you would fight for your children. When they are little, you protect them from the monsters under the bed and you liberate them from their worries. You never imagine hurting your child, and that fierce protection that you feel becomes so embedded in your being that you end up passing boundaries for your child that you wouldn't for another. For David, though, that wasn't the case. He was questioned as to what he did to protect his two children as they grew up under the tension of the household run by their mother, knowing the testimony that had been given by various witnesses before. The middle-aged man told of how he felt intimidated by his wife. She was educated where he was not, and her demeanour was volatile. He said despite all of this, he felt no real hatred towards the woman, and his only part in this whole affair was that after his children had committed murder, he tried his best to protect them from the law. David testified that John had deliberately implicated him in the crime, and that he'd never in any way discussed the way in which to kill his wife, no matter what his son said. He was clear when he said he knew nothing of the plot until after the fact, finishing his testimony once again, stating that John had told wicked lies. On the 10th of February, the trial was coming to an end, and summing up from the judge marked the moment where the jury would retire to consider their verdicts. Unfortunately, however, they could not come to a consensus quickly, and it wasn't until the next day, after a little under 8 hours of deliberations, that the jury were ready to announce that David, Glenn and John Howells were guilty of the murder of Eve Howells. The trial judge allowed 24 hours for the three family members to tell him exactly what happened and what was the cause before he would sentence them. However, nothing came of this. This was thought to be the first case in Britain where a father and two sons were found guilty of killing their mother. The boys were sentenced as juveniles and David received life imprisonment. Mr. Justice Alicott said that David was a thoroughly evil man who groomed or indoctrinated his sons to kill their mother while he was safely beyond suspicion as an actual participant. In the aftermath of this case, the press flocked to the home of Mr. Hurst, Eve's lover and now sole heir to her fortune. He wasn't in the courtroom when the trial came to a conclusion. From the doorstep of his Primrose Hill home, in his dressing gown, he gave a statement to the press. He was to say, "I'm glad it's all over and that justice has been done for Eve. At the moment, I want to donate the money to charity. Eve's money is not something I want on my hands. I had strong feelings for Eve. I was in love with her." The children's godfather was to speak of the boys too. "I have completely turned my back on them. It has been very harrowing for me. My relationship with Eve was still going on when she was murdered, and I did love her. I still do. She was a lovely woman who did not deserve to die like she did. Why she died, only those three know." All three of the remaining members of the Howells family ended up appealing their sentences. The boys were told that after their trials, their sentences would originally stand at 10 and 7 years respectively. This was reduced to 9 years for Glenn and 6.5 for John. The head of the family, David, also took his case to the Court of Appeal in hopes that his sentence would be reduced, and it was overseen by Mrs. Justice Swift. He was told that his original sentence of life imprisonment with a minimum term of 18 years would still stand, despite Mrs. Howells having many deficiencies as a wife and mother. The first time he would have been allowed to apply for parole was in October 2013. There is no details that I can find through research if any or all of the Howells family members have been released. It is very apparent to me that despite the horrid end to this case, there is a considerable theme throughout the stories told of the Howells family life. That being domestic abuse. This does not limit their responsibilities in their actions, but I do feel compelled to speak out. Domestic abuse and violence is not just a gender-defined issue. Anyone from any gender or sexuality can suffer due to partner abuse. In the UK, between 2018 and 19, 576,000 men were victims of partner abuse, about half of the total amount of women. Though this does not mean that men suffer less, but are significantly more likely to stay silent, with only about 51% telling anyone of their situation. It must be said that 11% of men also consider suicide due to the abuse suffered, which is a major issue when taking into account that 3/4 of suicides in the UK are male. In 2018-2019, 16 men and 80 women were killed at the hand of their current or ex-partner in the UK, which is just a sad reality. With this being said, there is hope and there is a safe way to access help. In the UK, women and children can contact the National Domestic Abuse Helpline by Refuge for free. Men can contact Respect or Mankind. All are online and via the telephone. Everyone can contact the police or their GP for access to help. If you wish to speak to someone specifically trained in LGBT abuse, then Gallup is a great resource. And finally, anyone can contact Karma Nirvana in relation to forced marriage and honour crimes. If anything, please just tell one person that you trust your situation and your worries, because you're really not alone, and you do deserve to be treated with respect. If you believe someone you know or love is in an abusive relationship, please use the resources listed to know how you can support and safely help them leave an abusive environment. In an emergency, always call 999. So, with that being said, now we have a promo for Eric over at True Consequences.
Hello, this is Eric Carter Landine, the host and producer of True Consequences, a true crime and mystery podcast with stories based in New Mexico and the American Desert Southwest. We'll uncover cases such as the Toy Box Killer, one of the worst serial rapists and suspected serial killers in New Mexico's history. We will also discuss mysteries such as alien sightings, as well as hauntings and other weird things that happen in this area of the country. I hope you'll give me a chance and listen to True Consequences. I think you might enjoy it.
You can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
It is one of my must listens every week. It's a really compelling podcast, so please show your support. All the information you need will be, as always, in the show notes. Now, at the end of every episode, I like to see if we can balance out those scales somewhat with a random act of kindness. This week, in light of recent events, I wish to highlight a way that you can make a difference about issues that matter. Wherever you are in the world, your government most likely has an official petition website listing causes that you can sign your name to and make actionable change. It's simple, quick, and with enough support, many of these petitions can get real results. So do something to change the world you live in. With that, go be good people, go be kind, go be safe, and most importantly, go be happy.